morning, the Joint Committee on Tax Reform is open. We are going to go through the actual legislation today that has been in the works for a few weeks with Legislative Council. Kate Taswell's here, and Dr. Warner. I would just kind of advise everybody to understand that this is just a shell, and a lot of the language will be updated, replaced, or not. So, but I wanted to see, I think it's important to see it in black and white language and to walk through it with the legal counsel. And essentially what it is it's the framework product from the work group that met for the first 12 weeks or so this year. So you guys want to come up? And this is on OLIS now. Mm-hmm. Once that's done, Dr. Warner's going to go through a couple of things, including a new computer model of what a commercial activity tax would look like at tiered rates, rates at 0.25 for wholesale, 0.35 for retail, 0.48 and 0.85 with some other nuances in there. And that will probably take up the majority of our time today. So thank you, Kate. Thanks for being here. Do you want to just do an overview, or do you want to just get right to it?
Sure. Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Legislative Council. I'm Kate Taswell, Special Counsel and Chief Editor. I think it might be useful to walk through LC 3549, the existing draft, just to get an idea of the framework. It is a pretty lengthy draft at this point. And then maybe we can have questions, discussion after that.
I will say, Mr. Chair, that Kate's earlier version had 198 pages. So she's reduced that to 111.
Smaller print.
Yeah, smaller font.
Not even close. Transportation.
So we're 500. So right on OLIS, that's LC 3549 that we should be looking at.
It is LC 3549, and it is the May 23rd version.
Okay.
So if I could just walk through it, if that's helpful.
Sure.
This bill, it begins, Section 1 is the only section that deals with the personal income tax. It amends 316.037, which provides for the rates, and it reduces each of the rates by 0.5%. It keeps the same brackets, and that section applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. Beginning in Section 3, there's the new commercial activities tax, which is a gross receipts tax. Section 3 is the definitional section for that provision, and it includes a definition of doing business, which is an Oregon-based definition of doing business. It exists in our current law. It then defines the term excluded person, and an excluded person, you'll see later in this statute, means someone who's not a taxpayer, or in other words, a taxpayer does not include an excluded person. And excluded persons mean pretty much all of the types of entities that are deemed to be tax exempt by virtue of nonprofit status under the Internal Revenue Code. So those are the provisions in Section 501C, which people are familiar with, especially 501C3, but then there are actually 28 other types of tax exempt nonprofits, and if they are deemed to be tax exempt by the IRS, typically that flows through to the state, and all of those types of organizations are listed as excluded persons in Section 3. There's also 501F, which is cooperative service organizations that support educational organizations, charitable risk pools under 501N, and there's also farm cooperatives. So in other words, all of these organizations through on page 5, line 10, are nonprofits, as deemed to be nonprofit, tax-exempt nonprofit organizations under the Internal Revenue Code. Then there's insurance companies that already pay the tax on writing certain types of insurance. So we get into both in the definition of excluded persons and then also in types of revenues that are not considered to be gross receipts, we get into situations where there's already a tax imposed in Oregon. So an example of that is cigarettes, where we have the cigarette and other tobacco products taxes, also beer and wine. So we move through the rest of the excluded persons, and there are a number of other types of persons, say persons that receive no more than 95% of their operating gross income from facilities for the elderly. Some of this already exists in Oregon law when we look at entities that are exempt from the existing corporate excise tax. So some of this has been moved in from that, and then other provisions mirror what we see in the Ohio CAT, the Ohio Commercial Activities Tax. Then, one moment. Starting on page 6, we see the definition of gross receipts. And that's at the top of page 6 in subsection 3A. It means the total amount realized by a person without deduction for the cost of goods sold, other expenses incurred, that contributes to the production of gross income of the person, including the fair market value of any property, any services received, and any debt transferred or forgiven as consideration. Then in paragraph B, we see the exclusions from the definition of gross receipts. Interest income, receipts from property used in a business, like-kind exchanges, I believe, securities. So there's a list of types of revenue that would not be considered gross receipts under this new tax. The bottom of page 6 in subparagraph F, compensation, is one of those items. Gifts and charitable contributions, damages, tax refunds. And then moving on to page 8, we see in paragraph Q, in line 5, there's a reference to motor vehicle fuel, which, as many of you know, is excluded constitutionally from taxation in this state. R addresses the beer and wine tax. So essentially, if you go through to page 10, there are the items that, by definition, are not considered to be gross receipts. Page 9. Line 13 on page 9 refers to the provider tax, which is section 2, chapter 736, Oregon Laws 2003. That would be excluded. Revenues of the hospitals that are subject to that assessment would be excluded from this tax. And then in line 15 of page 9, it excludes receipts from transactions among members of a unitary group. And unitary group is defined on page 10, and that is essentially in lines 9 and then, well, that's unitary business, in lines 16 and lines 9. That is the existing definition of unitary group and the definition of unitary business, which are already found in current law in chapter 314. And thus, transactions that are within or among members of a unitary group would be excluded from being considered gross receipts.
Okay, one question on that. Does that, on line 11, it says, as a general line of business such as manufacturing, wholesaling, or retailing, is construction considered among that?
Where is, I'm sorry, Chair Haas, where is?
The definition of unitary business.
On page.
Page 10, line 9.
Yes, I believe that that actually is a subordinate clause. So if they're in the same line of business, that's talking more about the members are engaging in the same same type of business. So if they were all engaging in construction, I believe that would cover that. It's not so much calling out manufacturing, wholesaling, and retailing so much as it is pointing to them all conducting the same type of business.
Thank you.
So are there questions around Section 3, which is the definitional section?
We're in a digestion mode here.
I can continue.
The questions will pop up about 3 in the morning.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that was exactly what I was suggesting.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair House. Section 3, page 8. It's interesting that you exclude drugs for cancer, anti-neoplastic drugs. Why not other expensive drugs for other conditions? Seems somewhat arbitrary.
Chair House, Representative Bueller, I believe that this is a situation where the definition hews pretty closely to the Ohio definition. Some of this is lifted closely from what we have in our statutes, items that are already taxed, but this, I believe, is taken literally from the Ohio definitions. So there's no policy choice that has gone into including this paragraph at this time.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, I think that's something that needs to, essentially is the value judgment that we should exclude drugs for cancer as opposed to treating people with hepatitis or HIV or a variety of other conditions. So this is a very value-loaded definition that I don't feel very comfortable with.
Representative Bueller, Chair House, indeed, this is, again, based on what's in the Ohio statute and is modified where that conflicts and cannot operate with our statutory scheme, but there are certainly artifacts that remain from there. Clearly, policy choices that the Ohio legislature has made at some point.
Mm-hmm. But
Representative Bueller,
we have to reflect Oregon values, not Ohio values, and definitions are important in reflecting those values.
I think that's a good point. We're borrowing from Ohio, Nevada, Washington. In the end, though, this won't be the Ohio plan. It'll be the Oregon plan. So thank you for that catch.
Yeah.
Shall I continue?
Please.
On page 10, we have Section 4, which addresses accounting methods and simply provides that the taxpayer's federal accounting method shall be mirrored in their approach to this gross receipts tax. And then in Section 5, determination of unitary business, here's where we actually address how that occurs, and that is based on current Oregon law. So in determining whether corporations are actually within a – corporations that are in a consolidated federal return should be considered to be unitary for Oregon purposes, and for purposes of this tax, their intercompany or intercorporation transactions would be excluded from being gross receipts. This is where we would look here in Section 5.
And the policy here is to limit pyramiding and all of these references to unitary business so that we're not pyramiding.
Correct. The concept, are these closely related? Or I'm sorry, Chris Allen, Ag Legislative Revenue Office. The policy is to restrict the closely related businesses, the transactions between those, and we're currently going with the unitary business concept, but that's correct.
In Section 6, this again is lifted almost entirely from the Ohio CAT and provides that there is property that's moved into the state can be considered to be taxable, and there's a cutoff of a year. There's also rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue to address whether this should be considered a taxable gross receipt. Section 7 provides, again, when addressing a unitary group, that all members of the unitary group are jointly and severally liable for the tax imposed under this new series. And then finally, Section 8 is actually the tax itself. And right now, it's imposed with some blanks.
Excuse me, Kate, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just wanted to call out, we've been going back and forth on calling it a commercial activities tax versus a corporate activities tax, and I just wondered if this was a decision that had been made yet or just to, we keep going back and forth.
It hasn't been a solid decision, but it seems to be commercial activity tax. This was put into the hopper before we kind of arrived at that consensus.
Great. Thank you.
So the corporate activities tax would be imposed on every person, which is broadly defined, that has taxable gross receipts. We see that there's already a definition of excluded persons, and there's also a number of items that are already excluded from gross receipts. So they would not be subject to this tax. The tax is imposed where there's substantial nexus with the state. But it is also not subject to Public Law 86-272. Public Law 86-272 provides that if you make a sale into a state, it is not taxable if it's purely based on a sale that is solicited from outside the state and an order that is filled from outside the state. That is a 1959 statute that essentially protected taxpayers in, say, mail order type of businesses. That whole area of law obviously is developed extensively. There's still questions around that in the age of online selling, but Public Law 86-272, by its wording, actually only applies to income taxes and would not apply to a gross receipts tax. So it puts it outside of operation for this tax, but this tax also does require that there's nexus to the state, and it's gross receipts within Oregon. So there wouldn't be jurisdiction of the state to impose a tax on gross receipts outside of the state, but not because of Public Law 86-272. It goes on to provide that it's an annual privilege tax and provides that it is currently tied to doing business in the calendar year.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this paragraph, if someone was already paying some sort of a privilege tax, would this stack on top? We're discussing, for example, in the transportation package, an excise tax on car dealers. This would appear to be the same thing with the two stack.
Representative Vance, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, earlier in the definitional section, you can see where there are a number of items that are removed from being considered gross receipts because they're already subject to taxes under our other tax laws of this state. For example, cigarettes, beer and wine, also the provider tax. So yes, I think the understanding is that it's going to be in lieu of that, that there wouldn't be, if something is removed, either because it's constitutionally impermissible to tax it or because it's already accounted for in another area, say the insurance taxes, it wouldn't be included in this, is my understanding of the policy behind this. It may not be specifically in this draft at this time, but once that came together, my impression would be that it would be removed from being taxed. And correct me if that's not accurate.
That's correct. Thank you.
So in Section 9, we have the rate of taxation. Right now, it's, again, definitely a framework. It has blanks. In this version, we start to see it being set forth in terms of sectors. My understanding is those sectors would be defined by the various NAICS codes, the North American Industry Codes. And Section 9 also provides for a flat tax at below a threshold level. So there would be a $250 flat tax in lieu of paying a tax with a marginal rate or a tax with a percentage rate. And that's all in Section 9.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that, thank you for saying that word that I can never remember, NAICS code. Is that something that filers self-designate? Or I guess I'm wondering how much if we were going to go into this different rate idea, kind of how much would that be self-declared versus, you know, externally, so we don't have a concern of somebody self-identifying as a kind of business that perhaps we might argue with them that they should be paying at a different rate.
Dr. Warner.
Representative Smith Warner, right now the data we have on the corporate tax returns is it's just self-reported because there is no consequence. But under this system where you have different rates, there would have to be their predominant area of business, and if they're audited, they'd have to demonstrate that that is indeed their predominant business. So it would be an auditing compliance enforcement issue for Department of Revenue.
Okay. Thank you.
So moving along to Section 10, which deals with citusing.
This is Kate, Representative Benz.
Thank you. this may not be the right place for it, but perhaps in a value-added tax, there's a feature that the person in a chain is basically reporting on the person prior to them in the chain. Does this particular device have the same function? Probably not, but I just want to make sure of that.
Just said it.
I don't think it would, because we're not calculating the part of the key thing with the value added tax is that you're just calculating that incremental piece. So you're not reporting that. It's the gross receipts that they'd be selling their products for.
The follow up. So yes, in the value added tax, you base whatever value you add upon the preceding party's activity. So it's up to you to kind of show what they did, and thus you almost act as a reporter, but that's not the case here.
I don't believe so, because the calculations are different. So with the value-added tax, you need to make a calculation either from the top down or from the bottom up as to what that company's value-added, the value of those products or services. With this, this doesn't have that calculation. It's just the bottom line sales in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Section 10 addresses citusing and sets forth principles for determining whether a gross receipt is actually citused to the state. And this, in a way, is, I believe, sort of the alternative to dealing with apportionment. Here we're dealing with where the gross receipts occur, as opposed to, in our current system, the corporate excise tax, which is actually imposed on the basis of income. There's also the corporate income tax imposed on income for people not taxpayers not doing business in the state. But with the current corporate excise tax, we have to look at the income of a multi-state company and decide how to apportion it between or among various states where that taxpayer is doing business. With this, we're looking at the gross receipts themselves. So in a way, should provide some simplicity. This language gives guidance essentially to the taxpayer and to the Department of Revenue as to how to determine whether the gross receipts should be citus to the state.
Kate, thank you. I want maybe Chris or Paul to expand on this, but this is the sort of market performance section, right? This came up in the ballot measure 97 as an issue that didn't have this because it kept the corporate income tax, and this was what had all the technology companies especially upset with, and this essentially says the sales are here.
Correct. It's the market based. It's not a cost or performance issue. That goes away. This isn't an income tax, so it is the market. So the idea is that for businesses who are benefiting or accessing Oregon's economy, the tax, that's the nexus for the tax. So they have to, the sales have to be in Oregon.
And Mr. Chair, this is what we've been calling destination-based. So the destination is where the gross receipt occurred in the market in Oregon. So, and that's all, this is designed to try to capture that base.
Thank you.
So starting with Section 11, we actually have registration for persons who are doing business in the state. So it provides for administration and enforcement, and it requires people to apply.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So let's just go back and just help me operationally. So if you have an international corporation, say based in Ecuador, who ships directly into the United States, how do you enforce that? Chair Hatch. Or China or Taiwan or...
Chair Hatch, Rep. Bueller. That, we're just now getting to the, there are certainly some challenges there, and we're just now getting to the point on the administrative side. It would be a whole new world for the Department of Revenue, obviously, and for these taxpayers who, for example, if they're located in Ecuador and they sell a small amount of tangible personal property under current law, they're protected under this 86-272, so it's not on their radar to pay the tax. Under this regime, they would be subject to the tax, and there would be an information process and advertising, I guess, or outreach by the Department of Revenue to make sure all entities are aware that they are subject to this new tax.
Follow up. So you have confidence that Oregon Department of Revenue can go to Hangzhou, China, and chase down a manufacturer that's selling directly into Oregon?
Well, I
determine what their gross receipts are?
Well, I think there are certainly challenges there. But it's also not the fact, I mean, there are challenges with the current corporate income tax system and auditing. The Department of Revenue is very busy, and they have a lot of resources devoted to auditing corporate excise tax returns. So I think the nature of the challenges change. But it's not as though we're going from a system where there are no challenges to a system where there are challenges.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. To follow up on Representative Bueller's question, let's use a real-world example. Amazon would not, I mean, obviously, as Representative Bueller pointed out, for us to figure out what somebody's doing in the highlands of Ecuador is pretty challenging, but I'm assuming in Ohio when they implemented this, I mean, the 800-pound gorilla is Amazon. They're the largest retailer. One of the very first things would Amazon would probably find themselves under scrutiny from the Department of Revenue, as they put it in Ohio, and saying, okay, you have a huge amount of online sales, so is this reflected? Even a simple question. That's the sort of person that's going to be captured initially. Am I missing something here?
No, I think so, and that's part of the advantage of piggybacking, if you will, off of other states and Ohio's experience. So to the extent possible, notwithstanding the conversations earlier around Oregon values versus Ohio values, those will certainly be incorporated. But to the extent we're piggybacking on Ohio, then for a company like Amazon, at least the starting point is, for the most part, we're like Ohio, so a lot of the same rules would apply, at least at the start here.
I'll follow up, sure. Really for staff, but it's like, one would assume that, you know, if you were going to do something like this, the logical sequence of events is for Oregon enter some sort of agreement with Ohio to say, I mean, what was your experience here, and, you know, what were the likely cast of characters in which you go out and start looking, and is that legal under federal law for us to enter in Department of Revenue from Oregon to enter into an agreement with the Department of Ohio's Revenue to say, when you implemented this, I mean, can you assist us in determining the types, if not the types, the companies? Because let's just face reality. The Amazon that I use as an example, there's probably 25 of them in the United States, and they're all very similar. Is that legal for us to enter into such an agreement to have that information from Ohio so that we don't start from scratch?
Senator Boquist, Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart. Right now, I would look to the existing multi-state tax commission and the multi-state tax compact, which provides a mechanism for states to operate, share information. We've had conversations about this in the past. It's not a compact on the level of, say, the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, which deals with extradition, but it does provide for informational sharing of information and also alignment of statutes within the various states. And so I believe there is definitely some leeway to do that, and also some precedent for doing that without running afoul of federal preemption or the like.
Thank you.
One thing, too, Mr. Vice Chair, is that we pattern this more closely after Ohio, but the Washington's B&O really is they have it in their statute, a destination-based tax. So the experiences that Washington's had, particularly with Oregon businesses, for example, where they're selling into Washington, would probably be helpful to us as well.
Actually, going back to citusing and looking on page 13, there's section dealing with siting of transportation services. We'd had a discussion about a previous version of this language, actually, again, based on the Ohio language, addressed air carriers and measured siting in terms of mileage of air miles. And there was a concern that was raised, and I agree that it's maybe problematic to tax air carriers. There is federal law and also federal statutory law and case law addressing that. So that language has been removed from this siting provision. Maybe there's another discussion about that, but I think it's more prudent to remove it. And this is paragraph F, starting on page 13, line 22. Again, starting on page 14, there are the registration procedures that are the basically implementing provisions for this, requiring that anyone who does business in the state register. There's application procedures, and section 12 provides that after the Department of Revenue examines applications, they can award certificates of registration to persons doing business. There's a lot of implementation language there for the registration certificates. Section 13 provides for revocation.
Question, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out the slight difference in language. Page 15, line 8, which says no fee need accompany the application, but then on the certificate, it specifically calls out they shall not, the department shall not, may not charge a fee.
Representative Smith-Warner, Chair House, Chair Barnhart, actually that was language that I was discussing with a colleague earlier today. It's not actually the language we would use in Oregon law. It's slightly ambiguous. Certainly these two provisions need to be synced, and there's also a policy choice whether there would in fact be a fee, but right now it appears that there's no fee, and again that's based on language in the Ohio statutes.
Thank you.
Section 13 provides that the registration can be suspended or revoked, and in sub 4 of Section 13 on page 17, that provides language that's similar to language in our current statutes. Essentially, the taxpayer could appeal this to the magistrate division of the tax court, and it would rely on the provisions of ORS Chapter 305, which is the administrative chapter for the Department of Revenue. And Section 14 is a temporary certificate. 15 provides that it can be canceled if a person basically is not in business, doesn't have any liability for at least 2 years. And then in Section 16, it talks about resale certificates, and I think this gets to the chain of sales, where if somebody is making resales or engaged in a retail business, they need to register that fact with the Department of Revenue. Section 17 provides that taxpayers who are engaged or persons who are engaging in business in the state need to keep records and receipts. That's pretty standard language compared to our existing statutes. And then in Section 18, it provides for a return, provides for it to be paid to the department, and also provides for the flat tax of $250 below a certain threshold to be paid. And 19 through 24 continue with administrative provisions. Section 19 provides for filing and provides that the Department of Revenue can extend the period for filing. And then Section 20 aligns the payment and filing procedures of the taxpayer with their regular accounting methods.
Uh, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go further into this part, I just wanted to point out another potential policy discussion we might want to have going forward. The registration element, is that a does the DOR do that now with taxpayers, or will that be a new thing?
Representative Smith Warner, there is a registration form that would be required for the new privilege tax. I mean, now we operate through the corporate income tax, but this would require registration where you'd, and I think we've looked at it, and we brought in the form, and you just go through a list what your entity type is, what your, in our case, what would be other members of your unitary group, and then you would file, and you would say, do you anticipate having sales or receipts greater than the threshold, that kind of thing. So you would have that on file with the Department of Revenue and be required to do that.
And then, thank you, follow-up. And then I would just suggest that we might want to consider, is that something that would kind of become public, just a list of who the registered companies are in the state versus something, because I know the Secretary of State's office has a, how would there be correlation there? Maybe there wouldn't need to be at all, but just that we're calling out statutorily this idea of all of these companies registering, mm-hmm. you know, what role is there for that to become what kind of public information about
but that would certainly be a policy choice for you, but that would be separate from the idea of making the returns themselves.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not.
Those are two different issues.
And just to be clear, it's me asking this, just to be clear, it's the listing, because the same way, you know, right now you can look up if there's a company operating in the state through the Secretary of State's right. website. I just wonder if this might be an alternative somehow linked to that.
I don't disagree with the good representative, but I just want to point out how utterly useless the Secretary of State's webpage is in terms of law and tax law. There is no ramifications whatsoever for not registering a corporation, business entity, or assumed name in the state of Oregon. The only legal ramification is one of us would have to personally sue that entity to try and get them to register. There is absolutely no teeth whatsoever in the Secretary of State's office in this regard. So for tax purposes, employment purposes, payment purposes and regulatory purposes, it doesn't do us any good. It's just simply a public access so that this entity decided that it would register and let us know that it's registered. But there is no teeth in that law whatsoever.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So looking under, on page 19, section 22 applies the existing tax law administrative provisions to this new tax. That language, ORS chapters 305 and 314, 314 is income tax generally, and 305 is the administrative chapter for the Department of Revenue. And this essentially says that those procedures, unless the context requires otherwise, would apply to this tax. That's language that we see in other series that provide for taxes, so addressing timing, claims for refund, and the like, we would essentially appropriate that language into this new series. The same thing with the lien and collection provisions that are mentioned in line 6 and 7 on page 20. So there are references throughout these sections to provisions in ORS chapter 314. And that's actually, that is a policy question, or at least an administrative question as we would progress with this, how the transition would occur in terms of amending some of those sections that are already existing in chapter 314. I think the references are clear, but it may be necessary to amend some of those sections further. Section 23 provides for the Department of Revenue to adopt rules for the new tax, and Section 24 defines successor and provides that the tax is immediately, essentially if a person goes out of business, the tax is immediately payable, and then the successor, if it's truly a successor in interest, would be liable, and that's typically a question of fact and certainly might be an issue to be explored if somebody actually is a successor in interest or is is not, depending on what sort of privity they have with the seller of the business or with the predecessor. And starting in section 25, it talks about collections and the disposition of the revenue. That is handled pretty typically. It's deposited into a suspense account, and then from there, in this version, the net revenue, so after refunds, after administrative costs, would be transferred to the state school fund. Language about a working balance of unreceded revenue we see in the current corporate excise tax and personal income tax. So the Department of Revenue retains that money sort of on a rolling basis to be able to pay refunds to taxpayers. And finally, in sub 2 of section 26, there's an appropriation to the department to pay the administrative expenses of the tax. And then in sections 27 through 31, it provides for penalties essentially people who fail, taxpayers who fail to file, fail to pay, who engage, and this gets back to the registration provisions, engage in business without registering.
Okay, excuse me, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The section 24, that bulk sale situation, is there an analogous situation now where a successor acquiring a business is responsible for those taxes? I know that in my practice, when you do this, you check to see if there are tax liens out there, and that's your notice. What notice would there be to the possible purchaser of a business under this situation?
I believe there are, Representative Vance, Chair Marhart, there are existing provisions about successors and interest, and I think it does amount to a question of fact whether you were on notice and how closely tied you were to the predecessor. And I believe that there are, in the current corporate excise tax, we have those provisions, if that helps to answer the question.
Well, I don't recall these, so when we do bulk sales, there was quite a process that one used to follow. It all kind of changed years ago, and I'm just curious if we're going back and approaching it that way. And this is too far in the weeds for this discussion, but it's and many times the businesses we transfer, I hope, would be far under the amount that this law might apply to. But I noticed that the tax appears to be owing immediately as opposed to when you determine the net income, because there is no such determination under this approach. And therefore, there wouldn't be the warrant and the other public notice that we now enjoy when we try to do one of these sales. So I'm just curious.
Representative Vance, Chair Marhart, I believe as this is written, that is accurate. I think that this may need further refinement because there is no lag time, right?
Right.
So after the subdivision on penalties, the final sections, section 32 provides for a financial institutions tax. This exists in Ohio as a companion to their commercial activities tax. It has a lot of definitional provisions, and also there's a section dealing with apportionment based on equity that is not included. This current provision on financial institutions tax, clearly on page 24, you can see that there's a blank amount as far as the rate goes, and there is probably further discussion as to whether there would be some sort of either apportionment or situsing provisions that would need to go along with this. But it does, as written, it does provide for a tax on a gross receipts tax imposed on financial institutions, and it uses our current definition of financial institutions, which is the definition in 314.610. And it would require that the financial institution have nexus to the state. So in section 33.
So I'm just trying to help me with how that would actually work. So if I'm a stockbroker that's in Eugene and I have a client who's in Arizona and the transaction occurs in Oregon, would there be a tax generated from that activity?
Representative Bueller, Chair Haas, I believe that's an example of how there needs to be further discussion of whether there are additional citusing provisions or apportionment provisions that would accompany the financial institution's tax. If you look at the Ohio financial institutions tax, there's a whole mechanism for basically apportionment. In this bill, we're moving away from apportionment of the corporate excise tax as it applies to most taxpayers. But in terms of the financial institutions tax, I think this truly is an example of where it's a framework. And probably there's further policy decisions and also probably legal questions that would need to be addressed in terms of that section.
Kate's definitely right. I think Representative Bueller about developing this more, there's broad direction for rulemaking to the department. But in terms of the policies you've been discussing, the examples you've looked at, if the customer is in Phoenix or somewhere outside the state, then it wouldn't be a gross receipt that was situated in Oregon. So it would be where the customer is what would drive whether it's a gross receipt that's subject to tax.
Yeah, that's to build on that from what Paul said earlier. It gets back to the destination based. It's the market for the consumer of that product or service, and then we get back to that destination focus, destination of the sale.
So,
Sam.
So what you're saying is, if I understand correctly, if there's a buyer from Arizona, for instance. And it, not necessarily financial, but it could be either way, comes to Oregon and purchases something and goes back home. That's not an Oregon sale. Is that correct?
I wouldn't believe so, but there are still a number of details. Those fine points are what need to be ironed out.
Understand, but currently your belief is that that would not be.
It would be counted as an export.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on Senator Riley's question for clarification, just use a farm example of the same thing. Have we gotten to the point in this draft of determining the farmer in Morrow County is sold his wheat to the Morrow County Cooperative, who then sold his wheat to Cargill, who then exported it to China? The question is at which point is it an export sale? We haven't got to that detail yet. I know we've discussed that in this committee and in the Senate committee of the follow-throughs, but in this text of this language here and the example raised by Senator Riley, or is that still situs to be determined?
Senator Bocas, Chair Haas, the question of the agricultural cooperatives is something that has appeared a number of times in not just this discussion, but also the discussions around the corporate minimum. I believe at some point there is an Oregon sale that occurs. With the cooperatives, with the patronage dividends and where those transactions are occurring, that is, I think, one of the more complex examples that we need to confront. Clearly, at some point, there is an Oregon sale. The issue is making sure that there isn't pyramiding or repeated counting of the sales throughout the chain. But obviously, at some point, if it's wheat, it leaves the state and it arrives, it leaves the country or leaves the state. At some point, I believe, an Oregon sale would occur, and there are gross receipts in the state. And that's, again, probably a question of fact, when that is.
To build on that, I think embedded in your question is we can't point to the language here. It's still a policy issue that we're working out, and the committee still needs to decide, and then that will help us fine-tune the language. I don't know that that there's language in here that we can say exactly this is where all those pieces fall into place yet. It's the draft is fairly new. So.
Representative Bueller. So just follow, fixated a little bit on this financial institution tax. So what would prevent me from just going to Arizona and buying $50,000 in stock to avoid the tax.
Chair Haas, Rep Bueller, are you talking about an Oregonian leaving the state to purchase it to come back?
Yeah.
I believe that because of the Oregon, this is another example of the fine details that we're still working through, but kind of on the fly here, if we're talking about an Oregon resident, then that makes it an Oregon sale.
So anytime an Oregon resident leaves the state and buys something anywhere in the United States or elsewhere, then that's an Oregon sale?
No, I don't think that could be implemented practically. So you travel somewhere else, and then that wouldn't establish nexus for a company just because you've left the state and purchased something from that company.
But that's what you just said with regards to me leaving the state and making a financial purchase.
I'd have to leave it as a detail we need to work through.
It's a big detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I saw somewhere in here that there's a time limit on repatriating to Oregon a purchase from some other state. Is that not correct?
Where was that? That's about it. Senator Riley, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, I believe that has to deal with tangible property. I believe that the question of the financial institutions is actually a separate issue. And with the hypothetical Oregon resident who leaves the state for a brief period of time to purchase a financial instrument, that I think is going to come down to domicile to some degree. If the person leaves for the day, purchases a financial instrument and comes back home, I don't know that that's not an Oregon sale, an Oregon gross receipt. But that, again, is something that would need to be explored specific to financial institutions in a way that's separate, certainly separate from tangible personal property, services, or other intangible property that is not a financial instrument. But I think it could easily turn on domicile. And if you leave for the day or you leave for the week, but you're an Oregon resident, I can see that there's jurisdiction to tax that gross receipt.
Senator Bertschinger, and then we'll let you finish this out, Kate.
Thank you, Chair Haas. As I remind the committee and everybody, anytime that we change the rules, that businesses are gonna react. They're not just gonna do business as usual. And I'll use the example that Senator Boquist with the wheat farmer and the co-op and the wholesaler. I think what happened in that situation is the wheat farmer would actually sell to the Chinese and just pay the co-op and the wholesaler to facilitate the transaction, thus eliminating the tax altogether. And we have to always remember that businesses are going to react to this. They're not just going to say, well, we're going to go along with it.
Right. I like your thinking.
Section 33 addresses the issue of the current credits against the corporate excise tax in ORS Chapter 317. There was a previous version of this that amended a number of sections that address the credits, and this replaces all of those amended sections with Section 33 that essentially provides if a taxpayer is allowed a credit against the current excise tax, against the Chapter 317 tax, for a tax year that's before 2018, so 2017 or earlier, and they still have credit available to them, whether it's a multi-year credit or it's a carry forward, under this draft, they would be allowed to claim that for the next five tax years or however many years that they have remaining against this current tax. So you would get to 2018 when this tax came into effect, and you could continue to claim those credits. So they're not repealed. They're applicable, but they're applicable to the new existing tax. So that would make them available to taxpayers under this new system. And to that end, at the end of the bill, there's applicability language that provides in Section 116 and 117. 117 provides for applicability and provides that this new tax, which is Sections 3 to 33, would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018, and these amended statutes, to the extent that they are amended, those amendments would be applicable starting tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. So therefore, sections beginning with Section 34, they are conforming amendments, and for the most part, they remove references to Chapter 317 and 318, which is the corporate excise tax and the corporate income tax. Now, there are places, especially in Chapter 314 and also in Chapter 305, which deal with administration, where there might need to be a further discussion about how the transition occurs. Because obviously there will be taxpayers who have liability returns for the 2016 tax year or the 2017 tax year that the Department of Revenue would need to continue to administer. They would need to deal with collections after this new tax came into effect. People might have refunds or amended returns going forward. And so most of this does address that, but there may also be places where it's not necessarily wise to repeal some of those sections yet. Rather, they're amended to provide for the department to be able to make the transition and continue to administer the tax under Chapter 317 to the extent that it's still something that needs to be administered, even though it doesn't apply after January 1, 2018. So are there questions about particular provisions?
Representative Benz.
Thank you. I can only imagine the complexity of what you just said if we were to put it on a spreadsheet, but perhaps you already have done that and can show us, give us a glimpse of the turmoil that the accountants of Oregon will enjoy unwinding. But have you such a spreadsheet to kind of show us, as opposed to, I mean, going through it is great, but it doesn't give us the scope of that which you just said. I mean, there's a lot of unwinding to do. How can we get a grasp of that? I mean, you call out here, of course, but the true on the ground impact.
Representative Bentz, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, I believe the main issue, in fact, is, or one of the larger issues is dealing with the credits and not just having a moment where the credits are not available to taxpayers. And so that, in a way, is probably easier to handle statutorily, but more complex in real life in terms of how they continue to be administered. Again, this only would apply to tax credits that are in existence, available. So a one-year tax credit where it isn't claimed over multiple years and where the taxpayer has used it in its entirety wouldn't be affected by this. It's the existing credits with carry forwards or the credits that are claimed over multiple years. I believe in particular the Affordable Housing Lender Credit, which is a multi-year credit and people have reliance on it, would need to continue to be administered. In some sense, though, there are other agencies that are addressing the actual eligibility of taxpayers and whether they are continuing to, they're their conduct is what they agree to when they applied for and were granted the credit. So that's one area. The other area is the administrative provisions in terms of refunds or amended returns, and so that would have to continue essentially on a separate track. Certainly for the 3 years where people can typically, taxpayers can amend their returns, that would have to be handled or a choice made in some way how that cutoff would occur, because you have someone filing for 2017 and in the spring of 2018 under the corporate excise tax in Chapter 317, presumably they would be able to file for an extension. They would also be able to amend going forward for 3 years. So that would need to be addressed. Some of that perhaps is in administrative rules, but parts of it definitely would be in the statutes with further detail as to how that would be handled, if that helps.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Rep.
Benz. Just so, am I correct in understanding that this tax is still an income tax, or still a, let me rephrase that. So if I am accustomed to taking a deduction of some sort against my income tax, is that deduction, anything, interest, rent, depreciation, any of the normal deductions that one might take, are they all affected in what way by virtue of this switch from an income tax to a whatever this is tax?
Representative Benz, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, my understanding and what is in this draft is with the switch to the gross receipts tax, with a broader base and ideally with rates that are adjusted that are actually lower than what the rates are in the corporate excise tax, typically the gross receipts tax does not envision deductions and credits, deductions or exemptions. Currently, we are relying on the deductions and exemptions at the federal level, and those are flowing through to the state return. And so we have a system that is tied, as we know, connected to the Internal Revenue Code, to the federal tax system, and is flowing through to our return. We're relying on those deductions, using the itemized deductions that are on the federal return on our state return. Those are all reflected as tax expenditures for this state. The idea of the move to the gross receipts tax is in ways it's simpler because you're looking at the gross receipts, but it's also, I believe, getting away from the idea of the deductions and credits. So it's a different base and it's a different marker. And so all the analysis of deductions and exemptions or Oregon subtractions wouldn't be occurring with this tax. But there would still be whatever was left over from amended returns from, say, 2016 or what have you, those would have to be dealt with. But those would be dealt with in terms of the 2016 tax year, not for the 2018, 2019, 2020 tax years, if that helps.
A follow-up? Right. It does help, and that gets to my point of expressing to those who have employed those incentives, otherwise referred to as exemptions, deductions, God knows what all, and the new planning that they'll have to do in light of this new approach to how the state chooses to raise funds. And that's why I was asking, how do we get a glimpse of that future without having to go through the next 100 pages of your presentation?
Representative Barnhart, Representative Benz, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, certainly I believe there are trade-offs both in terms of complexity, probably in terms of policy, but the idea being moving to a simpler return and perhaps a different rate structure. But it's a departure. It's certainly a departure from what's currently in ORS Chapter 317.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. So if I have a set of buildings and I'm in the rental business and I have a 35-year depreciation life and I just got into this business, what happens to those future deductions for depreciation that I had so cleverly relied upon when I decided to get in the rental business?
Representative Benz, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, currently, obviously under the federal return, that depreciation would continue to exist. As far as the pure gross receipts tax, that model, my understanding is it doesn't envision deductions. Obviously, there can be or credits or exemptions. Obviously, there can be modifications to that model where either there are certain types of gross receipts that are excluded, which we already have, or some type of deductions that are allowed. But at a certain point, I think you're moving away from a pure gross receipts tax. So it comes back to a policy choice, a policy decision.
Follow-up, Chair Ripon. So the question is, how do we get the measure of that, of this, the consequences of this change to those in the state of Oregon who have relied on the system that exists today, and as we move into the future to this new system, should we choose to do so? How do we get a measure of that? Or do we rely upon accountants to come in and suggest to us what this is going to mean? Is that, would that be the normal way of bringing forward the true cost of this change?
Chair Haas, Representative Vence. By measure, are you talking about the dollar impact or just the amount of work involved?
Sure. So the by measure, I mean those who have relied upon these kinds of deductions, these kinds of arrangements, this new world of the business activities tax, commercial activities tax, would perhaps thwart some of those arrangements. What I'm trying to get at is how much is that going to cost business in Oregon, that transition to this new approach? How do we get that measure? That's what I'm getting at.
Well, it is no doubt a significant transition from a corporate income tax to the gross receipts tax. And as Senator Barshary was commented, all of the stakeholders, all the businesses will respond according to their own situations, depending on the uniqueness of their business and whatever business planning they've done to this point. So it will vary a lot, I think, across the businesses.
I should mention, too, in the work group, there was a lot of discussion on a transition. Nevada went through this, and Ohio went through this. We spoke a lot about the carryovers, for example, and corporate tax credits, and that it was our view that those should be maintained out of a sense of fairness and whatever that transition is, whether it's 5 years or whatever. And I don't know if that's built into the what you have to say. I think it is, but while it's a significant change, there has to be some practical transitions built into this.
Mr. Femi, I agree with you. There would have to be appropriate arrangements made once we understood the consequences to address those costs for the, and that's what I'm trying to get at here. What are they? How much? And who can tell us so that if this change is made, it's not devastating to businesses who have made 35-year plans. That would be I'm not suggesting how bad it could be because I don't have a clue. I mean, but before we would do such a thing, we sure need to figure it out. That's why I'm asking.
Representative Renz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In line with that conversation, I think looking at what are also the additional benefits that come from that transition, because when I was looking at the previous rates, I noticed that some businesses that pay the corporate income tax with this new model will not have to because they don't meet that certain threshold. So it'd be good to know how many businesses will benefit from moving, whether how much money they save, but moving from the corporate income tax model to this new gross sales receipts. So we could see that balance of the benefits for many probably smaller businesses and the benefits for simplicity's sake when it comes to filing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following up with Representative Bent, in my analysis, and I've brought this up before, there's two pathways. You'd be looking at the federal pathway with the deductions and depreciations and all of that, and then you look at the state of Oregon with the gross sales. It's completely two, and the planning would be quite difficult. I think with the gross sales, the planning would be to have a high margin of profit, and that wouldn't work out with the federal side where a small margin of profit works out. So it's going to be really difficult for businesses. Do I plan for the federal model or do I plan for the state model? And I don't know how you're going to balance that out as a business. I think it's going to be very difficult.
Rep. Barnhart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been resisting responding to some of the comments, but I think I need to. The issue for the state is to figure out, I think, is to figure out a reasonable method of determining commercial activity and how state services ought to be paid for. The current model is based on income for corporations. This new model is based on a much broader, simpler approach with much, much lower rates in order to compensate for the fact that we don't have the normal business deductions in the system in order to account for the fact that the number you're working from is a much larger number, and therefore the rate is going to be much, much, much lower. We're used to thinking about businesses routinely, normally, properly establishing their affairs in such a way to minimize their taxes. I agree with your earlier comment, Senator, that businesses will continue to do that in a variety of ways in order to deal with the peculiar situations they find themselves in. You gave an example. I think that's a good one. But the final piece of my comment is state taxes are, in general, much, much lower than federal taxes. We tend to forget about that when we talk about various differences we might have between Oregon tax law and the federal tax law. But I think the reality is that most businesses, when they do their planning, are going to do it based on the federal taxes that they're most likely to pay. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to that, but when you deal with the various ways in which we might differ from the federal law, we always have to consider the fact that our tax rates are small compared to the federal tax rates, but they need to be adequate to pay for basic services, and that's the conundrum that a committee like ours always faces. We need to raise the money necessary to pay for the basic services that provide for the kinds of things that all businesses need, as well as all members of our society. Got to have an educated workforce. Got to have an infrastructure that functions. Otherwise, you can't do business. So that's ultimately what this is about. I think transitions will not be easy. I would predict that if we pass a bill like this, we'll be back making amendments in 18 for things we hadn't thought of. I'd be frankly kind of astounded if that didn't happen. But we can manage the things that we need to do. We certainly did when Measure 66 and 67 passed. We dealt with exactly the issues that were raised involving the farmers and the co-ops and the sale of wheat to overseas, and we can certainly do that again. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And everybody in the Revenue Committee, House and Senate, knows how often we amend the corporate income tax or the property tax. How many property tax bills have we had already this session? There isn't going to be an ongoing sort of refinement and adaptation. So go ahead and see how far we can go in the final 5 minutes.
So we were looking at Section 117, which is the applicability section. And essentially, just to recap, this would apply to calendar years and calendar quarters. That's for the new tax, Sections 3 to 33, beginning on or after January 1, 2018. And also for the existing ORS chapters, which are dealing with income tax generally, credits. There are actually some amendments to the personal income tax laws and to 317, the corporate excise tax, and 318, the corporate income tax. These changes would apply to tax years beginning on or after 2018. For the most part, the amended sections are conforming amendments. Where there are references to Chapter 317 and 318, they are removed. And then also in subsection 2 of section 117, it provides that even though there are these amendments and repeals of statutes, typically statutes that are in chapter 317, the corporate excise tax, they do not limit the authority of the Department of Revenue to enforce the previously imposed taxes, the 317 and 318 taxes that are applicable to tax years beginning before January 1, 2018. So that makes express that the authority to, again, deal with the amended returns or the extensions or what have you would continue. One issue that I think hasn't been addressed is that this tax is envisioned as an entity level tax, so it would be imposed on all entities other than the ones that are considered excluded persons. So for corporations such as S corporations, it would actually be imposed at the entity level, and we envision a credit that would flow through to the pass-through partners, as opposed to the current situation where we have a lot of a whole statutory structure dealing with S corporations and how they're taxed. They would not be taxed as they are now on the personal income tax returns. They would be taxed on this return at the entity level, at the corporate level. And so with all entities, as opposed to the current situation where 317 applies to C corporations solely, this would apply other than, again, to the in the case of the excluded corporations or excluded persons, it would apply to all entities at the entity level. And I think that, in a nutshell, sums up the draft. Most of what remains is conforming amendments.
Did you say in a nutshell?
Senator Hess.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. I just wanted to say thank you to Ms. Toswell for working so hard on the draft, first of all, and it's nice to have something that we can start from. I think it's, again, important to remember we are here as a tax reform committee, and now we're having something that we can actually weigh in, and I really appreciated the conversation today, but I have the utmost confidence that we are more than capable of making this shift here, and it may be a little bit bumpy at first, but that's why we have these conversations. We can start to iron these things out and hopefully get a solid bill drafted. And then in future years, if we have to make adjustments, then we would make appropriate adjustments. But we have a lot of examples from other states, and we have examples of what has worked and what has not worked. And so hopefully we can learn from other states. But to simply maintain the status quo, not that anyone was suggesting that we maintain the status quo, that doesn't seem to be working for us. If our tax structure was working, we wouldn't be constantly in this unstable system that we are in. And so I just want to say thank you and look forward to reading about the bill in more detail. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, many thanks for your work on this, and thanks in advance for the work you're going to continue to do as we continue to refine this. I'd refer to this as the lump of clay on the potter's wheel, but I don't think that does justice to the intricacies in this bill. So I would ask the committee to do your homework and bring suggestions, amendments, and changes to the chairs, the co-chairs, or Paula and his staff. Before we leave, we do have a computer model. I wanted to give Dr. Warner a brief minute to explain for your take-home.
Mr. Chair, just to introduce it, and I can spend some time on it on Thursday. I had a couple things in your meeting materials. One, Representative Buehler asked a question about expenditure data. And I have a great big spreadsheet from the 13-14 census, and I just put some ranking numbers on that. I have all the spending categories as well. So that's something to look at. If you have any questions on that, let me know. And then as Chair Hass mentioned, we do have what we call SIM 11, which is our latest combination of things. It is a multi-tiered rate system with a higher rate, similar to the B&O, for services. And then we have a lower rate for wholesale trade, which our models, of course, have shown to be most sensitive to a gross receipts type tax. And then we have a 0.35 rate for retailers, and finally a 0.48 rate for everybody else. which is basically what the B&O average is. We included a 25% CAT credit, and we also eliminated the pass-through rate, repealed the preferential tax rate for pass-throughs. And you can take a look at the simulation there, and we have also the static revenue estimates included in the material. So I suggest you look at that, and then I'll go through it with you on Thursday. And we also want to spend some more time. Chris has been working on some examples about pass-throughs. We've got a lot of questions about that again. So we'll try to flesh out that the issue of how pass-throughs are affected a little bit more on Thursday.
Thank you, Paul. Yes, look at these and look at the ways these numbers add up. I continue to hold out hope that we'll continue to, whatever combination we arrive at, that there will be an increase in jobs, an increase in investment for a positive economic benefit out of this, whatever it is. Did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So, Paul, just so I'm reading this quickly, correctly. So, based on the 13-14 U.S. Census data, Oregon ranks 7th in terms of state government spending as a percentage of income, so 7th on the top?
Representative Buehler, yeah, the two common measures. One would be per capita, where we rank 16th with $10,822. That's what the census defines as total expenditures. So that would be everything spent in the public sector. It would include trust fund expenditures. It would include government enterprises like OLCC. When OLCC buys from the spirits distributors, that would count as an expenditure, and then it would count on the other side as a revenue when it's sold. So it's a very gross measure of expenditures, and that's why I also included that direct general expenditure, which is pulls out things like the enterprises and so forth, and is probably a better measure of what goes to services directly. And you can see there on a per capita basis, we're about $8,800 in the 18th, and a percent of income about, we're ranked 10th with 22.6%. This would be state and local.
So the vast majority of other states in the nation are able to provide services per capita less than Oregon.
Representative Buehler, I would interpret those two numbers. The per capita is probably the better measure of, you know, the level of services, and the percent of income is more a measure of relative to the size of our economy. And so you get different answers from those two questions, depending on whether you're looking as a consumer or whether you're looking at it from a cost standpoint.
Just a point of clarification. But I think most other states, no matter how you measure it, get by with less expenditure than the state of Oregon, no matter if you measure it per capita or percentage of income.
Well, certainly the majority, yes.
Yes.
Rip Marvin. Thank you. A question on this topic. Is it clear that we're comparing apples and apples with these numbers, or because different states finance different aspects in different ways, that we're actually measuring things in ways that don't actually correspond to expenditures in other states?
Co-Chair Barnhart, what we're looking at is a very gross measure of what expenditures are. They can, certainly services can be delivered in different ways. Public sectors do different things in different parts of the country and different states, so none of those kind of nuances are accounted for. The other thing to keep in mind is, as from me, if you look, recall from your basic tax packet, the way it's financed differs a lot by other states. We, for example, have had a tendency to rely more on federal funding to finance those expenditures in a typical state. Mm-hmm. And so those have consequences, of course, going forward as well.
So this number includes the federal finance?
This number includes total gross expenditures. So, you know, if you look at the all funds budget, our federal funds revenue is actually greater than our general fund.
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah. If I could. Thank you. In addition to that, I'm aware from my work on a different committee that Oregon tends to do a much better job, believe it or not, of funding our pension system in many places. Is that included in these expenditure numbers?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes. The total per capita expenditures includes these government enterprises, and it includes trust funds, which would be public employee retirement, unemployment compensation, workers' compensation. Those are all included in this trust fund category and are not considered general expenditures by the census.
So if you look, if you're a state like Indiana, you'd be further down the list because you don't finance your pension. You pay it as you go.
Yeah. Or Illinois.
Or Illinois. Yeah, I mean, my point is that in order for these numbers to actually give us a correspondence with other states, you got to do a lot more work than simply presenting gross numbers, I think.
And lottery funds are included in these figures?
Yes. Under the expenditure numbers, lottery would be, you know, when the lottery makes expenditures for new machines, those are included in gross expenditures. So they're part of a government enterprise. So this is a very broad gross number summing up everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Adjourn till Thursday. Thank you all. Adjourn till Thursday.